Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Now, we're going to be taking a trip down a lane of mental expression, and that is the magical world of fiction. All of us enjoy novels and aspects of the imagination that a gifted writer can present. Well, that's what we're going to be covering today, but we are going to, on this holiday, we're going to be discussing something, and it's the underside of the art world. Ah, yes. The black market. What is it? Well, my guest today, Lolly Anderson, is a woman that decided to take on a challenge, and her book is titled Vermeer's Lady in Waiting. Do you know who Vermeer is? Who is the lady in waiting? Ah, that's what we're going to find out. Lolly Anderson, welcome to the show.
Don, I'm thrilled to be on your show.
Now, Lolly, you have such interesting background. One, you have been an attorney. You also evolved into the development officer, and you have to tell us what that is, for the National Gallery of Art. And then you became this writer. Well, my goodness, between the law and the art world, you got enough to write about for the next four centuries. Lolly.
That's right. It's a great background for writing. It absolutely
it is.
But
I mean, all this stuff. How did it
well,
start?
Law sounded like a good thing. That was an externally driven goal of mine. Sounded good, right? Mm-hmm. And I was in law for about 10 years, but, you know, it didn't feed my soul. And I would read articles of people at the top of their field. They loved what they did and would do it even if they didn't get paid. Well, I was on the alumni board at Mary Baldwin College, my alma mater, and helped with their fundraising / development work and loved it. And I turned that love, that volunteer job, into a career of 20 years and then ended up at the National Gallery of Art.
Now, this development positioning, what does that entail?
Well, it's raising money. It's called development, but, you know, director of the annual fund, major gifts, planned giving, that's all titles that quote development officer. So you're developing funds. That's technically what it is. But it's so it's not a land developer or, you know, who builds buildings or anything. It's a development in the world of fundraising and nonprofits. That's what they call it, rather than fundraising.
I am absolutely fascinated with how people like yourself, with the depth of experience that you have, will evolve into writing fiction. And, of course, I don't know about anybody else, but I love mysteries. I think they are absolutely awesome. I don't know that I'd make a very good detective, but I think that it's marvelous to see how the mind can create these labyrinths. And, of course, if somebody's ever studied history, this is always there. There's always these discoveries that come up. How did this happen? Who knew?
Well, I knew I loved museums, and my father was in the Air Force, and when we lived in the Washington, D.C. area, my mother would take me to the National Gallery of Art when I was, like, in the seventh grade. And I just have always loved museums. So I knew my novel was going to be about museums, but then it was, you know, talking to my former colleagues at the gallery and just reading, and I settled on the Nazi-looted art aspect because you will read articles in the New York Times and the L.A. Times, and I get a Bloomberg email about grandchildren are discovering their ancestors, their grandparents or great-grandparents' artwork hanging in museums. Mm-hmm. And auction houses and that sort of thing that the Nazis stole during World War II. So that just became my portal to learn about the history of World War II and how the Nazis confiscated I mean, wholesale art from individuals, museums, countries, but a lot from individuals, and wiped out their not only, and you know, they not only killed a lot of people, but then they took all their art assets, and so that's, you know, that's one theme of the book.
Yes, it is, and it's a theme though that leads into this marvelous mystery.
Yeah.
Now, Vermeer is an actual artist. And,
yes.
I mean, he's just very, yes. very talented artist. He didn't live very long.
Yes.
And you chose the title of a painting, The Mistress and the Maid. Tell us
yes.
about that.
Yes. Well, I just, the Vermeer expert at the National Gallery is a good friend of mine, Arthur Wheelock, and I just have always loved Vermeer. And Vermeers were coveted by the Nazis because the Nazis thought they represented Aryan culture. So Johannes Vermeer is a 17th century artist. He only we only know of 35 paintings that he produced during his lifetime, and I just loved it. And I knew that the Nazis not only coveted Vermeer's, but also there's a famous or infamous forger who created a lot of forged or fake Vermeer's, and one of them was bought by Hitler's right-hand man, Hermann Göring. And so that whole story was fascinating to me, and then I built on that and mm-hmm. made it present day, which, again, it is a present day issue in the art world.
Oh, very, very big one. Now, I have to tell you, anyone that brings up a St. John's suit in their book, that's a winner for me, because I love St. John's clothes.
I think the greatest. The greatest.
Yes, they just need to come down a little in price.
Exactly.
That's just a Donna piece of fluff.
But you could just wear them for years. And they stretch.
Yes, they do. It's just wonderful. Anyway, just that, like I said, that's a piece of Donna fluff. Now, let's talk about the history of Nazi art. You made a statement, I'm going to quote directly from your book, "The business of art was a pressure cooker exacerbated in a federal government kitchen."
Yeah.
Now, what is that all about? Because the art world has
uh-huh.
a very, very dark side to it. And this is something you bring up in the book.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of unethical people that are buying and selling things
yeah.
that are just,
uh-huh.
and this, again, you bring out, you give so much wonderful information in your book, and you give context, too, for people that are wanting to research. But let's go into that a little bit.
Well, that statement was made in reference to the director of the gallery, and of course, this is all fiction, but, you know, you do, when you're writing fiction, this is my first novel, and I took courses and talked to a lot of people and had editors read it. So I got a lot of information in the process. But you use composites of characters. You sort of, you know, you don't just take it directly, though. Some of my characters are directly from real people. But anyway, the director, when you think of working at the gallery, which is a federal agency, that you just have so many bosses, if you will. You have to answer to Congress. You have to answer to the donors. It's not just like working in a private you know, gallery or
mm-hmm.
organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it just puts a lot of pressure, extra pressure. And that statement was made in reference to the director might seem a little stuffy, like a stuffed shirt, but he's, after all, he's balancing all these different pressures. And but the, you know, what a museum has to be watch out for is, like, if someone wants to give, and I have an example in the book where a character's trying to give a Matisse to the gallery, they have to make sure what the provenance or the history of that painting is, because they do not want to accept something that, one, is a fake or forgery, or that was stolen and you know, belongs actually to a family in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
very
their
true.
Dilemma. That's their dilemma.
Very true. And there's still so much of this that is out there. Now, you
uh-huh.
have a plantation. I love
yes.
this.
Yes.
This is a southern
yes.
plantation called
yes.
Whittington.
Yes.
And
yes.
you have a Mr. Haywood that
yes.
is one of the characters.
Yes.
And then there is a prophetic dream. And, of course, anything with psychic stuff in it, I'm really going to enjoy,
I know, too. I thought you'd like that. I love that.
So you did this before we even had a chance to chat. So here is a prophetic dream, an old, old-time plantation that is not in too good a shape, yet it has a tremendous history behind it, and it is directly linked to this mistress and maid painting.
Yes.
And this character that you have in the book that has this prophetic dream, it's a woman.
Yes.
And she's innocently brought into an environment that she has had an association with for most of her life, which is this plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And this gracious southern woman that epitomizes the what I think is the finest reflection of the southern spirit. And, oh, my goodness, does the plot ever get sick. Oh, it is so, so good. And then there's a visit to a psychic. I like that, too. You had that. And then you have a touch of arsenic and mayhem. Aha. Well, let me tell you. Anytime you throw in a little bit of arsenic, it definitely is going to create some mayhem. But this ends up being a labyrinth that this young woman, this primary character in your book, goes through. And she is tossed into environments that just boggle her mind. This is the last thing that she's looking for. And it's terrifying. At the same time, in a way, it's exhilarating, and then there's all this confusion that goes on with it. When you were putting these characters together, were they alive to you in your mind? I have so many people that write that say it's like a muse that's sitting on their shoulder.
Yeah.
Did you have a couple of them keeping you company?
Well, yes, and again, several of my characters are based on real-life people, but you know, you change things about them. But so they were very much alive because they are based on real people. But and then the ones that are totally fictional, yes, they sort of have a mind of their own. And again, this took me either there's two answers on how long it took me to write this novel, either my whole life or 3.5 years. But you know, you just start building, and there's one character whose identity actually is something else. But I didn't know that till later. You know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait a minute. We're going to have an identity issue here. And so, you know, it just builds in the course of writing, that process. It's that, you know, the mind power, just like you talk about it, was just putting it together. And of course, you know, it's just hours and hours and hours. But and it just evolves.
Well, I think sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
Yes.
And when sometimes fiction, when you're reading it, many times later on you find out that so much of what supposedly was fiction is actually fact in many ways in life.
Yes.
And this is part of what you bring out in this book, Vermeer's Lady in Waiting. The fact that, number one, there is the real issue of stolen art. Illegally confiscated item. This comes up every once in a while in the news, where a museum in its archives, I'm sure in the Hermitage, because they have stuff that they haven't even taken out of crates that's still there.
Yeah.
I mean, it could take you 11 years just to go through the Hermitage in Russia to see everything that's on display. If you spent 1 minute, that's what we were told, 1 minute, looking at every single item in the Hermitage, it would take you 11 years, and does not include the stuff that is stored.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine what's in the Vatican's archives? Can you imagine what's in maybe some archives we even have in the United States? The Hearst Castle, there's still stuff that they've never unpacked that Hearst purchased. So you have these things many times that are put in places, and all of a sudden, something surfaces, and you never know. And there are people out there who rob, cheat, and steal many times. They're not wealthy people. They're the grave robbers, someone that's just trying to get by to feed their family often, and they get it to a middleman. Maybe the middleman knows what to do with it and then tries to sell it to the higher bidder, because there are many people that love collecting stuff. stuff, private collections that many times people have no way of knowing anything about. And you bring this out.
Yeah.
You bring this out. And lots of times, heck, we see it on the Antiques Roadshow.
Exactly.
And they say, how did you get this? Well, Grandpa had this, and then Aunt Lulu decided that she wanted to have it, and Grandpa said, okay, you can have it. And then I couldn't stand it, so I kept it up in the attic or down in the basement for 45 years. And I just was curious. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I used to work for PBS, and that show was not expected to be the runaway success it was. But people were all, you know, we want to know something is authentic. We want to know its value. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a huge argument in the art world. Well, if it's a good painting, what difference does it make whether it's by, you know, a famous painter or not? But we all want to know what's the history and is it authentic? And it's just true that in the art world, because there's such high dollar items, people will create fakes that look like the real thing, and even fool experts. And it happens, I mean, museum directors, you know, very sophisticated art collectors know this. You can be fooled. And so it's a dicey issue if you're going to be an art collector. But, of course, everyone, I mean, there's still a huge part of the world who are going to always do that because they're works of art. So they're cultural treasures. So.
Well, I was intrigued with the different historical pieces that you included in Vermeer's Lady in Waiting, this fabulous book. You have information about a woman silversmith in America. Her name is Hester Bateman. Now, tell us how you found out about her and why you wove her in. I just thought that was amazing.
There was a quotation in a calendar I bought that said, write the book you want to read. And I did. And I love silver, particularly old silver or hand wrought silver. And I, just like in the book, I was, as a development officer, was calling on a potential donor, and they had Hester Bateman silver. And it's just exquisite. And so the donor, just like in the book, told me about this woman silversmith who was illiterate but produced, thousands of works of silver and was this famous woman silversmith in England. I just think it's such a fascinating story. So I have my, you know, the main heroine, Millicent Claremont, who solves the secret code in the overpainting of the painting, the Vermeer's Lady in Waiting. But I just wanted to mention these other women heroines because,
oh my goodness, I had no idea.
We're all, you know, there's so many women heroines, like the Lillian Rice, who designed, one of the first women to graduate from the University of California, designed Rancho Santa Fe. So I don't know. You know, it was just something fun for me to add. I just wanted to.
I think it's awesome because, again, you fold in all of these yummy tidbits. I just loved it. And
Thank you. You
brought in something regarding the painting technique that people use for forgeries and Bakelite. I mean, there are people that are collectors of Bakelite jewelry. And
that stuff
is amazing. And I'm not interested in it, but I know a little bit about it. And it is hot stuff when it comes to value. Bakelite was a very unique process. Talk about how you found out how this is used with forgery.
This was just when I was doing research for the novel, and Han van Meegeren was this famous forger who created these fake Vermeers during World War II, and that's what he used, Bakelite, because if you have to make a painting look old, so he would take an old canvas, scrape it, paint it over it, and use Bakelite, and literally put it in the oven. And so it has the cracks, the very fine cracks that an old painting has. That's how you create the illusion that it's really old when it's, mm-hmm. of course, just newly produced. But isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, let's talk about the salt mine, where
yes.
the Germans stored thousands of pieces of art. Now, we
yes.
have a huge salt mine. I believe it's in Utah.
Uh-huh.
Where I think it's Utah. I could be wrong. Maybe one of my listeners knows. But it is a huge repository for the keeping of records because it keeps everything dry, all the
yes.
containers, and it is something that has been used for storage of all kinds of things, arts, et cetera, and that's right here
uh-huh.
in the U.S. You talk about how the Nazis used the salt mine
mm-hmm.
as
right.
the war was escalating to
right.
store.
Right, they were sort
of,
yeah, so they were basically shipping the biggest one that was found by the Monuments Men, this group of principally Americans who, anyway, found this old Aussie salt mine in Austria, and thousands, 6,000 paintings, just paintings. But the reason salt mines, they have a moderate temperature and moisture, and it's constant, so that is really good for storing art. So it was like the perfect place to store and preserve them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so fortunate that the Monuments Men found, there were also women involved, but men and women called the Monuments Men, but it was so fortunate that they found the old Aussie salt mine, and because a lot of that, the artwork was sent back or restituted to the country of origin, and some I think got back to the original owners. But it was a tremendous thing for World War II to turn around some of the tremendous harm that the Nazis had done to the cultural treasures of the world. I mean, they really did a number.
Yes, they did, and a lot of it ended up in South America.
Yeah.
And then some of it started coming to light in the underground world of the black market with art because they needed cash and they would sell it. But
mm-hmm.
I have, through the years, I've heard stories of people that mm-hmm. were in South America that saw
yes.
collections that were
mm-hmm.
just breathtakingly phenomenal.
Yes, and well, because
and
a lot of the Nazis went to, yeah, particularly Buenos Aires, and that's
mm-hmm.
going to be in my next book, Buenos Aires, but
oh, ah.
And just a follow-up to this, but yeah, anyway, I have to mention one thing before I forget. My husband was a Presbyterian minister. He went to San Francisco Theological Seminary and the University of Edinburgh. His first church was University Place. Right there in your neighborhood.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
In the late 60s, early 70s. And he is a fantastic preacher. Oh, my gosh, he's like Peter Marshall. He's fantastic.
Oh,
and anyway, and then he had, anyway, he was also in biotechnology. But anyway, I just wanted to make that connection. And he, so here's a Presbyterian preacher, and he's saying to me, I can't believe you have the philosophy in your book is told by a psychic. I said, that's right. and then I had this editor in California who's really, really good and had made some really good suggestions, but she said, I don't know about using the psychic. Maybe she should be a, you know, just a therapist. I said, oh, no, no. I cannot take out my psychic. And she's, the Diane Miles in my book is a combination of three psychics that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
So she's a composite of real
smart.
People. But anyway,
yeah.
I couldn't take that out because once you witness it and you know, someone who has the psychic gift,
mm-hmm.
you never question it because you know it's real.
Yes, yes. When you read the right one, now I want to cover a couple of points in your book. Yeah. Number one, this is a point about how the Nazis were protected by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
the art
mm-hmm.
collection was protected, those things that were stolen. And this I know for historical fact.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I came across that information just, I think it was about 5-7 years ago. I picked up some material. And I was appalled. And
yeah.
I had access to some material with someone that had able to go into the Vatican and able to go into their archives, and everything is so carefully documented.
Mm-hmm.
They were appalled. This person was a very, very strong Catholic. They wrote their book because they said people need to know the truth. Here's all of this information. So you bring this out, which I think is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But also, another aspect that I was really intrigued with, because when it comes to the world of art, there have been so many cases of museums around the world having illegal items that they have bought, sometimes knowingly, sometimes not knowingly.
Right.
And you have this wonderful composite, and of course, you bring up the Metropolitan Art Museum, you bring up a number of different aspects of that. But what I really found gripping was the infrared reflectograms, x-rays, technical exams to find a fingerprint.
Yeah.
Now, this was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You got to talk about that. What is that? How do they do it?
Well, it's just, you know, I mean, the scientific test that they will, you know, put a piece of art through, if you will. But, I mean, they examine, so they take x-rays because they look at the underdrawings. And an artist, they'll know, like, for instance, Vermeer, you know, how many underdrawings did he do in his other paintings? And so a lot of times forgers won't have all the underdrawings because they're just copying something.
Mm-hmm.
So they find out through x-ray. They will take a sample of paint as the size of a grain of sand and chemically be able to tell when the paint was made. And so Vermeer would use cobalt blue. Well, if you have to, then Vermeer got sloppy later. I mean, Hans van Meegeren, I'm sorry, the forger, got sloppy later and didn't use that because it was hard to get. Well, if it's a later paint, well, then you know it couldn't have been made in 17th century or, you know, whatever the timing is for their, you know, where the painting's supposed to have been made. So it's fascinating. But so they have all these, this is, that, I didn't get very technical. I got a little bit technical. They have many, many scientific tests, x-ray type, chemical tests that they go through to check off to say, is this painting authentic or not? And it's just fascinating. Now, there's this one guy I talk about who would look at fingerprints. He's a little bit, I don't think he's widely accepted in the art world.
Mm-hmm.
But you can look at, sometimes fingerprints can tell you something and sometimes not. It just, you know, there's, because they're, again, these are such high dollar items, it's just like in the medical field, there are good doctors and not so good doctors. In the art world, there are good appraisers and not so good, and, you know, all along the line. And so you have to be really careful. So you know, if you want to be an art collector, you need to develop some personal relationships with those in the field, someone you can trust, and do a lot of research, a lot of due diligence.
I think that this has so many aspects to it that just really intrigued the mind, because you've included so much fact in this book, Vermeer's Lady in Waiting, and it even includes the IRS folks. So, I mean, we've got everything in here. We have got so many aspects that it's a delight to read. We're coming into the fall. We are in fall of the year, and we're having shorter days, which makes me a little sad because I love all the golden sunshine we've had in the Pacific Northwest this year. But it's happening. So instead of watching television, why not have a good book? And why not have a book that is based in a current environment, deals with psychics, the dark world of the black market, in the, well, artifacts, paintings, whatever, a love story, all kinds of good things thrown into here. It's a bouillabaisse. And it's going to really be enjoyed by whoever reads it. And if nothing else, you'll learn some things about the art world that you never knew was there. Vermeer's Lady in Waiting, Lolly Anderson. It's been a delight having you as a guest. Check out her website, Lolly Anderson, that's L-O-L-L-Y Anderson, and that's S-O-N, .com. I'll tell you
.dot net.
.net.
Yeah,
I beg
sorry.
Your pardon. .net. And I think you will have a delightful time. Lolly Anderson, thanks so much for being my
Donna,
guest.
That was great. You are a great, great interviewer, radio
well,
host.
Thank you
so much.
It's been my pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. Hey, if you like mystery, I do. So why not have fun? It's a good book to read. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. If you want to call in and chat with me, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. And you don't have to do anything. Just give me your first name or initial, and of course, I'd love to know where you're calling in from. And then after that, I'll tell you what I perceive, and if you have a question, gee, all you have to do is ask it. That's simple. Doesn't cost you a dime. Just a little bit of your time if you're interested. 888-627-6008. Let me tell you, we are going to have a powerfully dynamic guest tomorrow. If you have an interest in the Kennedy assassination, if you are interested in history, Russian history, we're going to be talking about two of his novels. The man's name is Chris Adams. Now, my guest that I had previously booked, she's in the hospital. She's quite ill. So I happened to make a connection with Chris. I've gotten his materials, and they are knock-your-sock-off materials. And it is fiction, but it has so much. He likes to call it faction writing because he has such a background, not just in the military, but in international, shall I say, intelligence, that I think you're going to find extremely fascinating. We are going to be talking about The Requiem of a Spy. That is tomorrow. And then we've got Peter Shapiro. Yes. And then with Peter, we're going to be talking about ghosts. On the Red Line. That is on Wednesday. Then Brian Chrissy is going to be my guest on Thursday, Common Sense in Uncommon Times. What would you do if a disaster hit? This is something that where I am in the state of Washington, a friend sent me an email just day before yesterday asking if I was aware of what had been going on with a weather front that had passed through the Washington area. Well, we had gotten hit with a big storm, but no biggie. I was shown photographs of a potential tornado. A tornado in Tacoma, Washington, Seattle? You got to be kidding. It's happened. So we're going to be talking about how you deal with disasters. Return to joy. Mark Nepo is a man that really believes that we should be aware that we can have joy in our lives. But we need to be mindfully aware that we produce it. It's just as easy to produce heaviness, oppressiveness, Oh, my goodness. Dependent on how we've been raised or what environments we've come up through, dominion over our own minds is something many times we have to learn to take responsibility for. That is not easy. Dependent on what you've gone through. So I think Mark Nepo is going to give us a lot. And the information regarding the show's upcoming will be posted. So just know that that is going to be coming online. Oh, we have such a dynamic lineup for this month. And I am so delighted that you're taking the time out of your very busy life to spend it with me, because I am just delighted to be able to bring these people into your environment. And isn't it terrific that you can have a portability with all of this now? There's so much that's available to us because of technology. And that is absolutely amazing in my mind. I was watching a movie last night. I'd gone to the library. I love public libraries. As you know, being an avid reader of 400 to 600 books a year, you have to have, an interest in one of the best institutions that's around, and that's the public library that was established by Carnegie so long ago. Well, they offer videos, and I happened to get the movie Big Miracle. Now, I had heard about this, and it came out about a year or so ago. And it's about the three whales up in Barrows, Alaska, that were trapped in ice. And I have had a wonderful affinity with the far north for so many years, and I know how quickly weather can change. And I have talked with people that live up at Point Hope and up in Barrows. And so when I was watching this movie, it was very poignant. But what was even more important to me was the reality of this really happening. This was a true story. And the fact that it took so many people, both from the native population as well as from what we call the outsiders, the world outside, that is so distantly removed from the harshness of certain environments of weather and conditions, and also how there was a Russian icebreaker that enabled these whales finally to be free. And my thoughts were at the end of the movie, by the way, if you haven't seen it, please get it and watch it. It is just wonderful. But one of the things that was really very poignant to me in this whole experience was how, because of the need of releasing these animals back into the ocean, they've gotten trapped. When this occurred, everyone dropped their hatred, their biases, and they worked together as a team for a common goal. And I was so impressed with it. They saw something bigger than themselves, their ideologies, their fears, their ignorance, their indoctrinations, and they worked together. And the result was the whales were able to go free, even though the baby did end up dying. The adult whale survived. To me, I thought, when I watched this, how is it that under these circumstances, people will let go of old belief systems because something bigger than themselves says, let's take care of it. Let's do this because it's the right thing to do. And then, all of a sudden, after everything is said and done, people go back, and they go right back into their old conditions, their old attitudes, their old fears. What does it take for us as a global population to come to an understanding that our three biggest enemies are ignorance, fear, and superstition? If we allow those enemies to corrupt us, if we allow systems to erode that part of life that really is healthy, harmonious, and beneficial, we go back into our old costumes. Again, of fear, ignorance, superstition, you can add greed, you can add a number of adjectives if you wanted to. why can't we come to a more common purpose of saying, we need to improve things, let's work together. We can have harmony. We can do things. We don't have to be at war. We don't have to destroy people, our planet, everything. It's not necessary. So when I watched that movie, I thought, here is one tiny example. One tiny example. And if collectively the consciousness grows and changes enough, then we can really make a difference. But if we stay stuck with the wrong kind of attitudes, if we stay stuck within our fears, if we stay stuck in old belief systems, it doesn't work. We're going to keep going through this mucky murk until one day something happens. And I personally feel that it will be by Mother Nature to give us a real call to wake up. I think that there is so much in life. There is so much good. We have so many things that we can do. Sometimes we have to get out the scrub brushes. And the first thing to do is we need to clean up our own thinking. We have to start with ourselves and then have the ripple effect. Be willing to walk the walk of integrity, purpose, good character, solid values. It really can make a big, big difference. Now, I want to share a story with you. By the way, if you want to give me a call, at 888-627-6008. There's a man by the name of David. He lives in Indiana. I loved this story, and I think it sort of dovetails with what I was just sharing with you. He was called by his classmates, or one particular person, "Hey, filthy Felsy." Now, I don't know about you, but I went through something like this when I was in elementary school and junior high, and it was extremely painful. And this guy's name was Chim, and he was a bully. And he was a pretty big guy. He was playing on the football team at junior high. And David, he was a pretty good runner. He was in the seventh grade when a lot of this stuff was going on. And he was just in a dilemma. Chim was this great, big, huge guy, massive guy. Now, David's this slender fellow, seventh grade. How's he going to beat this guy up? Fat chance. He hadn't taken the martial arts. He didn't know about any of that stuff. Well, this is what happened. And this is how David handled the situation with the bully. And he presented him with a challenge when the bully started coming at him again and using words and just being awful. That's the word I'll use. Chim was just awful. So David decided to do something a little different. He didn't run away from Chim. He challenged him. He said, "I'm not going to run from you, but I will race you." Now, Chim was a lot bigger, like I said, than David was. And, of course, Chim, being a bully, and this is a typical persona of the bully, he thought, "Who's this wimp in front of me? This wimpish kid? I'm Superman. I'm going to beat him." Okay. He said, "All right. That's the deal. But we have a condition here." Chim says, "What's that?" He said, "You will not bother me ever again if I beat you." Well, Chim didn't think that he could be beaten. So he said, "Okay, if you win, I'll leave you alone forever." Now, David was shaken in his boots because he thought, "I'm totally insane. Why in the world have I even made this kind of a comment?" Well, by golly, he decided to do the race. He said, "Yes, let's do it right now." Now, Chim, because he was so arrogant, decided he was going to give David a 20-foot advance. David said, No. "We'll start from the same spot. We're going to end at the same spot. And here are all of these people witness to it." And David started running. When goal was announced, he took off, and so did Chim. Now, he left David in the dust. David was running it. Part of him was getting very discouraged, but he wouldn't give up. And he just said, I'm going to beat him. I'm going to beat him. And he kept running. And all of a sudden, he got an extra surge of energy, David did. And he ran faster and faster and faster. And he left Jim behind in the dust. And he said after that, nobody ever called him Filthy Selfie again. Pretty smart thinking, don't you think? This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to come back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call in if you'd like to chat with me is 888-627-6008. Well, I love ghost stories. What about you? I really enjoy. In fact, I'm still in the process of accumulating stories about paranormal experiences, and I came across this one, and this is about a New England ghost. Yes. And this is a true story by a man by the name of Raymond Buckland. Now, he came into the United States in 1962. And he lived on Long Island, New York, and eventually, about 10 years later, he moved up to an area in New Hampshire, and he and his wife purchased a home at Weir's Beach. Now, in that part of the country, you have a lot of these old houses, and they purchased a house that had been built in 1825, and he said it was just gorgeous. It had an attached L barn, a stable, there were outbuildings, it was two-story, it was sitting on a couple of acres, and just gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Huge living room, wonderful beam ceiling, and the room ran the length of the house on the west side. And he said, we just loved this place. There was a staircase that went up the center of the house, front door was at its base, and there were four bedrooms above. And on the east side of the house was the kitchen, and Raymond said, I had chosen one of the rooms there for my study. And his study had two windows that looked out to the front and one that looked to the side. Now, he said an addition had been put on the house that had a screened-in porch that ran across the full front of the house. You definitely want that when you're on the East Coast because mosquitoes, they just come out by the gazillion. Now, there was a door at the east end of the porch that opened onto a paved path leading to the garage and to the driveway. Now, the house was haunted. They became aware of that very, very quickly. I know here in the Sebo house, we have a friendly ghost that keeps us company. Actually, we have more than one. And we have a little girl, and when we have a very dapper guy that lives in this house, He's been in this house for as long as we've been here. Well, this is how they became aware of the haunted environment that they had moved into. Whenever they'd sit downstairs in the living room, they'd hear footsteps walking about in the bedrooms above. That sounds familiar. That's what we have happen here. And Raymond said he particularly remembers one time when the footsteps walked across the room above, and it was his elder son's bedroom. The bedroom was in the front of the house, and then started coming down the stairs. Now, he said, my wife and I were sitting in the living room, and we both turned to see who had come down since neither of my sons was home. And we expected the person to come around the corner from the foot of the stairs into the living room. Nobody showed up. The footsteps stopped at the bottom of the stairs. So Raymond gets up out of his chair and goes to look. Nobody's there. Staircase is empty. It's the spooks. On another occasion, his wife's grandmother was staying with us. She was sleeping in the elder son's bedroom, and one morning she came down to breakfast and reported a nighttime visitor. She said she had awakened in the middle of the night to find a woman standing at the foot of her bed. There was a nightlight in the room, and she could see that the woman was wearing a long blue dress. This woman looked at her for a few moments, turned around, and just slowly disappeared from her vision, fading away to nothing. And then Raymond said, I saw a figure once. I was in my study when I heard the screen door bang and looked up to glimpse a man crossing the porch to go to the front door. As I got up from my desk, I expected to hear the front door bell ring, but it didn't. I went and opened the door and looked out, and there was nobody there. The porch was empty. There was no one outside or anywhere in the driveway. And the screen door invariably squeaked when it opened. No squeak on this occasion. He said, we lived in this house for 5 years, and we became very comfortable and accustomed to our ghosts. And he said, they weren't negative. They weren't bad ghosts. It didn't cause them traumas. And he said, we really were sorry to say goodbye when we eventually sold the house and moved away. Do you have a ghost story of your own? I'd love to hear it. Why don't you send me an email and send it to Donna@DelphiInternational.com or DonnaSebo@Comcast.net. You see, these experiences go on all the time. And so often we are encouraged to look at this kind of stuff as the negative, but it isn't. My dogs, my Scottish Terriers, have seen the visitors we have in this house, and I just think it's absolutely fascinating. Because of these visitors, and I had a chance to talk with some of our neighbors, I found out our neighbors knew all about ghosts. I learned about Indians that had lived in an area that's right close to where we are. So much of history is so fascinating. And that often creates, well, not unlike the author we had today, Lolly Anderson, an opportunity to bring things into a light that makes us aware that there's much more to this experience of life than we could ever imagine. And I love it because the stories never end. This is Donna Sebo. I know that we're just about out of time. And by the way, I want to let you know, those of you that are in the state of Washington, I'm going to be doing an appearance at the Emerald Spiral Expo in Kent, Washington. And that's going to be coming up and on September the 28th, that is a Saturday, and we're going to be giving you more information about that as we get closer to the event. So just know that, yes, after a summer of not having too much in the way of public appearances, Donna's going to be out there again. And also for those of you in Alaska, I am going to be appearing up in Alaska in the month of October, and those details will be coming forth. My newsletter went out yesterday, and I hope you enjoy it because it is all about the hawk. Yes, the king of maneuvering. Maybe I should say the king or queen of maneuvering because there's the male, female. But, oh, it's just, it's an amazing animal, very powerful animal totem. So that's in my newsletter for this month. And if you are not on my mailing list, you can always let me know that you'd like to be included. That goes out free to you every month with a listing of my guests, etc. But also know that there is an upbeat feel with that. And you can go on my website, check out the newsletters. You'll see it posted there. and you'll be able to enjoy it at your leisure, whenever you like. This is Donna Sebo. Enjoy this awesome day that you have. Remember always that you're the master of your fate, the captain of your soul. Don't ever give your mind or yourself over to anyone else. It is too valuable. Enjoy who you are and the journey of discovery that is meant to be yours. This is Donna Sebo. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.